Michael Gilland is the author of this book, The End of Life as We Know It, Ominous News from the Frontiers of Science. We'll get back to some of the other things that he's concerned about. Now, I mean, the book is not all doom and gloom. I mean, there's some pretty exciting, fun, interesting things that are coming from the frontiers of science. And then a couple of things we want to keep an eye on. I'm saying. How about you? And it will be the end of life as we know it. Life will carry on, but what will it be like? We'll talk more about that in just a minute. Also, we'll bring you in on the conversation at the bottom of the hour. We'll give the numbers at the bottom of the hour. Then next hour we go to open lines because it's Friday. George has got the night off. I'm sitting in. And I want to get back to some of those ghost stories that are up at coasttocoastam.com. So I'm giving you the heads up to look for that story about the ghost that moves the jar. You can see the video. It's in the carousel, as we call it, the rotating stories at the top of the fold of the website at coasttocoastam.com. Watch that before we get to open lines next hour. I'd love to hear your explanation for it if you think there's kind of a science-y one. Get to that next hour. In the meantime, let's pick up this conversation about cyborgs too, about the idea of blending human physical animal life together. It's not just about splicing. It's more than that. We'll get to it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. I want to make sure to leave some time to talk about future of privacy, where we rest right now at this frontier of all of this home technology with Michael Gillen in a moment. But I wanted to wrap up that conversation about transhumans, as you talk about them in the book, people who are becoming part of something else or use physical enhancements from technology to be able to compensate for either for injury or for deformity. And there's a couple of those that are very entertaining, like the guy with the built-in vibrator and some of the other stuff that's that's in the book. But the part I thought that was really interesting, and I wanted to mention it because I think this idea of the exoskeleton, I know several people who have trouble walking, or they have lost their ability to walk, or they've had spinal injuries, and this to them is a dream. I mean, the idea of just being able to walk across a room because of an exoskeleton that carries their body or retrains their muscles or stimulates their muscles or all three. I can't think of a downside to that other than the military application, I guess. But where are you with that one?
No, I agree with you, Ian. I think that, the discussion that I have in the book about transhumanism, and there's actually a movement called the transhuman movement, where, as you say, the idea is to enhance ourselves one way or another using technology. And I break it down into three categories: there's the usable transhuman augmentation, so there's usable, there's wearable, and then there's implantable. And I agree with you. This is an area where I see very little downside. I mean, I tell the story of this guy from Dayton, Tennessee, he was a power linesman. He touched a high voltage line that was lying on the ground, and he lost both arms, just zapped them right off. Now, here's a guy who would have, lived the rest of his life, severely crippled. And now scientists are creating for him what are called neural prostheses. But see, these are artificial arms, but not like your grandfather's artificial arms, that were mechanical, that required you to wear a harness and you have to.
Right.
No, these are arms that he can move with his thoughts. So they're wired to his mind. And
that's amazing.
Fantastic. Oh, yeah. And another story that I tell about the woman who is a quadriplegic, and now, she's able to have some level of independence and because of some of the transhuman augmentation. So I agree with you. And even in the military setting, I mean, if we can outfit our soldiers so that, they're wearing an exoskeleton, and I talk about how Hyundai has come up with some stuff there.
Yeah.
Where, so poor soldier who's out there and he's carrying, a 50, 60 pound backpack, if we can give them an exoskeleton that takes some of that load off of their own skeletons, I think it would be a stretch to find fault in something like that.
Yeah, maybe I've seen RoboCop more times than you have. I mean, I think that, I mean, and I do. I'm not being facetious. I think that's the only one I'm. Here's why. There's always this belief somehow that if we can come up with a technology that saves our soldiers from harm, inevitably that gets weaponized into, and yeah, we can invade without losing any soldiers, and therefore there's no political consequence, you know, from that. Back to that idea about maybe some of our advancements should not be consequence free, is that I think that that's, you know, I get worried a little bit, and maybe that's the science fiction part of me, that I see that politicians would revel at the thought of not having to be accountable for anybody's death by having super soldiers that can go in and take whatever we want until the embittered enemy that we've created does us one better, and then inevitably it's a new arms race.
No, you're absolutely right, Ian. And I talk about that. But you know what's interesting is you look ahead to what this technology is pointing to. And, you know, we're talking about enhancing a human soldier's abilities. But I think equally realistic will be, robot warriors, in effect, Terminator-like warriors that will be our surrogates going into war. And so we spare.
What could possibly go wrong there?
Yeah. And, you know, I quote.
That sounds like a plan.
Yeah, I know. And the Kalashnikov group, you know, I quote them in the book in Russia, is very upfront about them doing that. They're in the process of doing that, and they're talking about unveiling some of their stuff soon using neural nets. This is just a fancy way of saying these are robot warriors that have human-like brains. The question then becomes, do you give such warriors the right to make the decision to shoot or not shoot? In other words, you give them complete autonomy. And right. And that is called the Terminator conundrum. Right now, nations are thinking about, well, gee, if we give our robot warriors complete autonomy, then that's basically going to make Russians do the same thing. And now we're going to be, as you said a moment ago, Ian, we're going to be now in another escalating arms race. And so,
right.
You know, it, in some ways, you know, I often think to myself, you know, yeah, all this technology is brand new, it's unprecedented, but we kind of are just still the same, you know. So all our faults and our foibles and our weaknesses and our downsides just get magnified by this technology. The technology doesn't eliminate our weaknesses and our foibles and our downsides. You know what I'm saying to you?
Yeah, I do. And yet I would propose to you maybe the biggest problem we would face in the law of, you know, unintended consequences would dictate the Sarah Connor conundrum, not the Terminator conundrum, but the Sarah Connor conundrum, which means if you can't win a conventional war because you're overwhelmed by the technology of your opponent, you go unconventional and you go guerrilla. And this creates more terrorism. So, you know, I mean, that's how eventually she was able to beat the, I don't want to spoil the ending for anybody that ever saw Terminator, but, you know, I mean, that's how, you know, she won, is eventually learning to guerrilla her way out of it, not to face the enemy, but to beat the enemy by, you know, going at his weaknesses. But pause that for a second, because whenever you mention Russian scientists, I'm reminded of the story about the scientists that want to put an old head on a new body, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Full head transplants. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So let's pick that up. That's one of those Halloween-y kind of moments right there where you're like, all right, no, there. This is one of those nightmare dream things, depending on where you are with it. I could understand if somebody had a body that was decaying, but their brain was brilliant, and you wanted to put it on a new body. But then where does that end, and how far along are they in that pursuit?
Yeah, well, you know what? I've been reporting on that story for some years now, and it began with a small number of scientists who experimented on monkeys. And it gets a little grisly, but this being Halloween, okay, where they severed the monkey's head and then they reattached it just to prove that they could. So there's a lot of plumbing involved, right? I mean, you have to sew up the veins and the arteries and the nerves and so forth and so on. And scientists have achieved a level of success with monkeys. And so now, emboldened by that, they are turning their attention to doing it to a human. And there's at least one guy in Russia who's been quoted frequently, who is quadriplegic, you know, otherwise mentally very alert. And he says, yeah, come and do it to me, man. I'm ready. I want to be that guinea pig. And there are scientists who are quoted as saying, yeah, they're going to do it. So we're once again, you know, remember, I'm old enough to remember the first artificial heart transplant.
Sure. Yeah.
Remember that? Jarvik.
Sure.
What was his name? Jarvik, right? Or
yeah.
Something like that. And everybody cringed at, oh my God, what are you putting a mechanical heart in a human being? And, you know, it was in South Africa, right? And
yeah, exactly.
And you know, now artificial hearts are a pretty routine thing. Although now, you know, with stem cell research and other things going on, we're even getting past the mechanical hearts. Hey, by the way, Ian, you talk about things that give me some pause. Here's one. There are three groups of scientists in California and Minnesota. And, you know, I read that. It's like Minnesota. That's like so random. But, okay, there you are.
No, you that the University of Minnesota is a monster for stuff like this. Yeah, it's a huge research. Right. It's an R1. It's a big school.
No, you're right. You're right. I just I don't know why. It just gives me a chuckle. But anyway, you have three groups of scientists who are creating creatures that have never walked the face of the earth before. They're called chimeras.
Right.
They're sheep, human, and pig human chimeras. So these are creatures whose DNA has been knit together using human DNA and sheep DNA, or human DNA and pig DNA. And they're creating these creatures because they will have human organs. They will have human kidneys, human livers, human hearts, for the purpose of, you know, transplanting them to patients in need. And, you know, I get that. I had a friend who died recently because his kidneys just went south and he couldn't get a transplant, and boom. But now what that's done is to raise the very real possibility, and I discuss this in the book, that if you put too much human DNA into the recipe, you know, so it's always a question, too much human DNA, too little human DNA, then you don't get the human organs.
Right.
If you put in too much DNA, then you can have an animal, a creature that thinks like a human, that has basically a human brain, trapped inside of a body of a sheep or a pig. I mean, these are the things that are very real now because of our ability to tamper with DNA. So that's one of the things that gives me a little bit like, do we really want to do this? And what's interesting, Ian, is that these guys are doing it. And by the way, I quote one of the researchers that says, yeah, that's a real possibility. So this is not like, you know, made up pie in the sky. I mean, even the researchers admit, yeah, we got to be careful. This is a possibility. But they're doing this research against the wishes of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which is the government's number one funding body for biological genetic engineering. So even the NIH is kind of very, you know, forward-thinking funding organization is saying, you know, ooh, maybe we should just push the pause button and decide, do we want to do this? And if so, what are the guidelines? What are the guardrails?
I'm sure these guys are not just doing it in violation of the NIH. They're probably doing it against the advice of their moms, too. Yeah. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. You know, it reminds me, oh, my gosh. It reminds me when I was growing up in East L.A. and then Montebello, which is a town over. And I was a real geek. I mean, I was geeking out when I was a kid, and I found a way to make hydrogen gas using stuff that I found in my mom's kitchen. And I look back, and I'm out there in the garage of our house. Making hydrogen gas, and you know that stuff is explosive. But I would fill balloons up with it, and then send little insects aloft just to see what happens. I was a little mad scientist in the there, Ian.
You created your own space program against their will, right?
But
by
like
the way,
these guys with the Chimera, you're right. The mothers would say, "What are you doing? Get out!
Right.
Stop doing that already. Go play Tiddlywinks or something safer."
Since you mentioned L.A. Since you mentioned L.A., I want to mention that the game is still tied in the 15th between Boston and L.A.
Are you kidding me?
No. So I
they're
just thought I'd
15th inning.
15th inning, game three of the World Series. Richard tweeted out on Twitter.
God.
He said he's listening to this show and watching the World Series game. He said it's like syncing up Pink Floyd and the Wizard of Oz. He said it kind of works. And so I don't know. I guess that means I've committed a lot of errors, because that's how it's happening. But right now, still, there's two men on in the top of the 15th, and we'll keep an eye on it. So, all right, so the Island of Dr. Moreau thing's pretty scary. It really is. But I still, you know, now that you think of what the technology that people you see all the commercials for, which, you know, for Siri, you know, what, how cold is it outside? I don't want to look out a window. Yeah. Siri, is it snowing?
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, Google, it'll buy me some, you know, buy me some more tin meat, whatever. And these commercials, everybody's focused on that type of assist. And I kind of get it. But we're just beginning to learn the downside of having a microphone connected and unmonitored inside of one's house, aren't we?
Yeah, and that's another. It's interesting you bring that up, because that was on my short list of things to worry about, and that's something we're bringing about ourselves. Okay.
Yep.
You're absolutely right. I tell the story of a little girl in Dallas, Texas, who used the Amazon Echo, you know, and said, "Hey Alexa, buy me a bunch of cookies. Hey Alexa, buy me, you know, this dollhouse, this fancy schmancy dollhouse," and parents are totally clueless. The stuff starts arriving at the house. The parents freak out. But here's the punchline, Ian. You would think that the parents will have learned a lesson and, like, ditch the Echo, you know, get rid of it. But instead, I have the mother quoted as saying, you know, we need to whisper around Alexa now. Are you kidding me?
Wow.
I mean,
wow.
That's the takeaway? I mean,
that's so weird.
In the room.
Yeah, I know.
Right?
But it's so Big Brother in a way, too, because it's not just, I mean, that story, and again, I remind people, we'll get to the phones here coming up. They're already ringing, and we'll line up people to talk with Michael Gillen, the end of life as we know it, in a few. But that story out of Turkey about the, supposedly, the audio recording that was made by this guy Khashoggi's, you know, Apple Watch, that they were able to monitor his Apple Watch and record his torture and death. Now, I don't know that I believe that. I don't know that it really wasn't just microphone implants. Or, for that matter, maybe there in the Saudi consulate, they have Google, and they have the little Siri, whatever, and they monitor it that way. But however it happened, that kind of, that passive listening that is going on, that we have not yet fully come to terms with what that could mean for our jobs, for our relationships, for our communities.
And for the security of our country. I've just penned an op-ed that's going to be published very shortly. U.S. Congress issued a report on Thursday, so saying that the Chinese are hell-bent on exploiting the vulnerabilities of something called the Internet of Things, and that's what we're talking about. This is a kind of a
your refrigerator, your dishwasher, everything that's connected.
All these smart devices that we're talking about, the Alexas, the smart watches, the smart, as you say, refrigerators, the smart thermostat, on and on and on. There are now more than 8 billion Internet of Things devices. So we call it IoT. I talk about it in the book. And the Chinese see this as an opportunity to bug us, to spy on us. And we are the willing accomplices, because we're buying these gadgets, bringing them into our own homes. You talk about the Khashoggi thing, Ian. Whether that's true or not, it's entirely possible. And I tell the story in the book of a woman who was murdered. And I don't want to give away the story, but she was murdered, and the police started looking into the situation, and the husband was claiming one thing. He said there was an intruder in the house. He came in, he killed his wife in the basement, and the police started looking at things, and they found she was wearing a Fitbit watch.
Hang on to that thought, because we'll need to hear the end of that coming up after this break. Then we'll give the numbers and everybody can join in the mystery. The end of life as we know it, Michael Gillen. next on Coast to Coast AM. In for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. By the way, if you go to coasttocoastam.com, you'll find out where George is going to be next. Tickets are already on sale. I don't know if you saw that story. I caught it on CNN. Cleveland Cavaliers tickets post-LeBron are going for as low as $2 a ticket. Ow. And yet, people in Cleveland are still averaging a higher attendance rate than the Lakers are with LeBron. So, got a little catching up to do still in Los Angeles, and some catching up to do in that World Series game, too. I'm not going to keep giving you updates all night, but I'll let you know when it gets resolved, because we've got phone calls to get to, and we'll also get back to those stories we mentioned earlier in the show. Open lines coming up at the top of the hour. If you haven't seen the video yet, it's on the website. If you can explain what makes that jar move, I'd be very grateful. And a little less frightened. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. All right, Michael, before we start getting to all these calls waiting for you, let's roll that story back about 20 seconds before we, because I had to cut you off, but we were going to the bottom of the hour, and it's a hard break, so I couldn't pass on that.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just telling you the story of a murder that happened in Connecticut, and the husband claimed one story, and the police looked into it. His wife was murdered, and he claimed one story, and what the police found was that the deceased woman was wearing a Fitbit. It's one of these little smart watches that, you know, keeps track of your heart rate, how far you've walked, and so forth. And so they downloaded the data from the Fitbit, and they found out that they could actually, get this, calculate how many feet she walked, and it didn't square with the story from the husband. And then other things started happening with Facebook. In other words, what I'm saying is,
sure,
the technology outed this husband. He ended up being charged with murder because of this kind of Internet of Things that are spying on every aspect of our life. They can tell you when you're asleep, when you're awake, how many feet you walk, what's your heart rate. If you watch Netflix, they download what you're watching, when, how, for how long. I mean, this is a kind of an invasion of privacy, but we've invited it on ourselves in. We are buying these gadgets.
Yeah, and I like a lot of them. I mean, I wear an Apple Watch. By the way, they use that as a plot device, that thing about the Fitbit in a Law and Order episode last week. It's the exact same thing.
They probably took it from the real life story.
Oh, they do. They always do. Yeah,
no.
Ripped from today's headline. So but that's where, I mean, I think that, like, to catch a killer is one thing. Like, people listen, they go, oh, good, they caught a killer because of the Fitbit. The hard part will be is when evidence is presented in court that's collected from some of these ancillary passive data collection systems, which accidentally convicts somebody who didn't commit the crime. I mean, that hasn't happened yet that I know of, but that's going to be the real test of this technology.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I talk about the FBI now having this humongous database of face prints.
Right.
That they
That's your cover.
And they have like an 80, they allow themselves an 80% accuracy rate. So the question becomes like, okay, well, that means you have a 20% inaccuracy rate,
right,
which raises the possibility that you and I could have the FBI knocking on our doors because they think we committed a crime based on their database. But the facial recognition technology that they're using to ID and to finger culprits is wrong 20% of the time. And by the way, researchers who are looking into it from Australia and elsewhere are saying it's more than 20%. And so this what you just described is a very real possibility now, where innocent people are going to be fingered by AI screwing up.
Michael Gillen, the end of life as we know it. Let's get to Keith, who's in Virginia on Coast to Coast AM. Keith?
Hello, can you hear me, Ian?
Perfectly.
Good. How are you tonight? Oh, I'm getting my phone turned back up.
There you go. And you had a question for Michael?
Yes, Michael. And I heard you speaking about the jar of a card. I have a couple of friends, one of which would be a great guest because of his varied experience. and service even as a whistleblower. He's called in Coast to Coast AM before, but it'd be great to have him on to tell a story about a lot of things. One of the predecessors of that artificial heart was a heart-lung machine. And Dr. Russell and Nelson worked on that at the University of Minnesota. I understand that the Jarvik heart was at the University of Utah, and some 30 years earlier. And he, in his career as a heart surgeon, had some paranormal experiences, one of which was where he did a surgery, but a technique that had never been done before. And he describes it as, after praying to know what to do, that basically it's as if a schematic or whatever was put right in his mind, and he did the surgery from those instructions that he was able to see in his mind. And later...
I got to get to a question because there's so many people who have questions for Michael. So if you want to hang on for an open line call, this sounds more like that. But did you have a question for Michael?
That could be, yeah. Russell and Nelson, by the way, is...
I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to put you on hold right now, and just let me get back to that because I know there's our time is precious, and I open lines is where that kind of belongs. So let me go to Tracy, who is trucking in Alabama, with a question for Michael Gillen. Tracy?
Michael, I got one question for you here. Where does it end? Where does it stop? When do we stop playing God?
Or are we? Have we? That's a good question, but are we playing God yet? And when don't we play God? Maybe is another question, but Michael?
Well, I think that is the ultimate question that Tracy's asking. And, I quote a very well-known biologist in the book who was actually a major participant in mapping the human genome. Remember the Human Genome Project?
Sure.
It wrapped up in 2003, and there was a big ceremony in the White House. Bill Clinton was president, and he said, now we have discovered the language of God, now that we have mapped the human genome. Well, this biologist, Craig Venter, I quote him in the book, and it's a very telling quote, and I have to be careful, but he says, when it comes to biology, we don't know blank. I'm not going to use the word he uses, but he says, when it comes to biology, we don't know blank. Now, this is a guy who's in the thick of it, and this is directly an answer to Tracy's excellent question, that in effect, what Craig Venter himself is saying is, look, we're toying with something we don't know squat about. And that is a recipe for danger. Picture a child playing with matches, or worse than that, playing with a nuclear bomb or playing with a dynamite. You pick your imagery. And that is really the picture that emerges when you read my book. Whatever you think about the technology, and there's a lot of positive, but let's keep in mind that you can have 99 positive consequences, wonderful, sunshine, positive consequences, like the neural prosthetics. But all it takes is one stinker that can be within, right? That overshadows everything else.
But I think that's the crux, too, of the playing God premise. Are we playing God, or aren't we, when we cure a disease? If the disease is natural, it was as God made it, natural on the earth as hurricanes, are we not playing God when we cure a disease?
I get what you're saying, and that's why I tend to avoid this phrase, although I know it's a popular phrase.
Right, that's God. What I'm saying. It's too weak to use for that context, because it doesn't really encompass all the ways in which... when we make a better brake pad, or when we do, there were always attempting to try to save lives, and sometimes those will come with unintended consequences, but was that really a matter of playing God? I think it's more true with the Chimera thing. I think that gets into a very weird area, though.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think, it's like when we restore sight to the blind with these retinal transplants. That can be said we're playing God.
Right.
So what I like to do is, when I was at ABC News, I covered the Persian Gulf War story. You remember when they lit the oil fields on fire?
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally.
I was I was the first television correspondent to actually find my way to those oil fields that were lit on fire. And the way I had to get there was through a minefield. We got a guy from Aramco, the Saudi Arabian oil company. He knew a way through the minefields. And so that's how I think of Tracy's question is, I see us there. I see us navigating a minefield. And, you know, so far we've been able to avoid stepping on that one mine that's going to do us in. But as we progress with some of this stuff that is unsettling and outright dangerous, never mind the great stuff, okay, that's going to be sunshine. But as I say, all it takes for us to do is to step on that one mine, that one hidden mine, and it's just going to blow us up.
Okay.
And it remains to be seen. I think that will be the end if it comes that way.
Now,
That's the ultimate end.
Okay, so you're the scientist. You got the PhD in physics. Let me just give you what I think is a better metaphor, though, for science, let's say that the goal is the other side of that minefield. Well, you're just simply going to have to say, there are going to be X number of scientists who are going to have to run through that minefield. And if enough scientists run through that minefield, the goal will be achieved. You know, there will be some casualties along the way, as there inevitably are. The premise that I'm most worried about is not whether we get blown up in the minefield, because science blows up all the time, right? But is whether the goal is worth achieving in the first place. And that's the part where there's no national consensus on whether this is a goal that, and I think that there's a lot of education. I remember, and I'm sure you're older than me or the same age as I am, as I remember being told by an aunt of mine that a cousin that was being born in the family wouldn't have a soul because she was a test tube baby. They won't have souls. God didn't make them. They won't have souls. They'll be like zombies. They'll be like, and it's like, no, they weren't. So, I mean, I think some of it is an education piece. And I think that's where great science writing and science journalism, a book like this, is really helpful, because it really makes clear to people how complicated these issues are, but what's the great benefit or not for us in the long run. That's the part I'm focused on myself anyway.
And I think you're absolutely right, and that is why I wrote the book. People can have their own opinions, but you have to be well-informed in order to have a sensible opinion, right?
Yep.
So after you read this book, you'll be well-informed, and then God bless you with your opinion.
Right, and God bless you. In 5 years, this book may be totally irrelevant, right? Because by that time, science advances. You're going to have to write a sequel. The end of the world is end of life as we know it. Let me get to Jason in Portland for Michael Gillen on Coast to Coast. Jason?
Yeah, the act of playing God is kind of baked into our DNA. When they say that we are created in the image of God, that kind of, you know, is put into our existence then.
That's a fair point.
Now, into my question, before I get, if I read the your schedule right, aren't you going to be talking on the subject of immortality on Tuesday night?
Oh, Coast may be. Yeah, I won't be on. But,
yeah, right. give a little plug for an upcoming show.
Thank you.
Question, you were talking about immortality, and I don't know exactly where it is, but in the Book of Revelation, it talks about immortality. And when the wrath of God is poured out upon mankind, it says that they will pray that they would die, and they're not able to, and they ask for the mountains and the stones to come down and cover them up. And are they talking about this period that you're talking where we've achieved immortality?
Oh, this is an interesting premise, again, is whether immortality would be a blessing or a curse. That is the portrait of Dorian Gray. What's your thought on that, Michael?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts about that. And that is, number one, obviously as a theoretical physicist and as a serious minded Christian, I'm fascinated by finding references in the Bible that might give us some glimpse or some hint as to what's in store for us and how it jibes or doesn't jibe with what's going on in science. I just find that it's fascinating, intellectually fascinating. And so I'd love to think more about this reference to Revelation. I think also my other thought is, you know, does a supercomputer, and this is a kind of a mental question or a mental experiment that people talk about a lot. Will we reach a point where we create an artificial intelligent being, whether it's in the form of a big computer server or it's in the body of a homunculus, a kind of a human-like robot, but gets so complex and so beyond has an existence that is beyond the human experience that you cannot unplug it?
Yeah.
It's like
that Skynet.
It's like running on energy that it absorbs from the environment. That's a scary thing.
Or from the crushed souls of the people it stomps on, going to get itself coffee. Yeah, I get that. I think
that happens with some of our technology now, right? Haven't you ever been in a situation where, you know, you're like trying everything. Stop, piece of machinery is going crazy. Stop. And finally you unplug it and it still goes on, you know?
tell me about it. I've spent the last 2 weeks trying to get a Kenmore Elite dishwasher fixed. So that's exactly, that's exactly where I'm living. And by the way, too, as somebody I have a Master's of Divinity degree. I would just say it's really interesting about the Bible in this. The only problem is the Bible is multivocal on the subject of immortality, life after death, etc. So it's really great because it creates more conversations, but it doesn't always resolve them. So keep that in mind. Let me go to David, who is in Arizona on Coast to Coast AM. David?
How you doing? Hey, my question for you, and I'm going to make it very simple. In the ethical and moral conflict created by doing these things, artificial intelligence, would be the result?
You keep breaking up, dude. You're killing me because it sounds like a really good question.
Again? Seriously.
Did we just lose him? And we just lost him. Oh no. All right. Well, James is in Washington. Let's try him while we still have a minute for Michael Gillen before we go to open lines coming up on Coast to Coast. James?
Yeah, I enjoy your show, but I've been on a kidney machine going on 45 years.
Yes, sir.
And I also have macular degeneration. I'd like to know from your guest when he feels that these two will be overcome through CRISPR or maybe genetic modified pigs. I'll take my answer off the air.
Hang in there, James. Hang in there, James. We need every one of you. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, what kind of, I didn't get, what kind of machine is he on?
He's on dialysis. He's on kidney machines, and he has macular just like degeneration.
My friend, yeah. No, I think this is where the technology really is very hopeful. They are making enormous strides now with restoring people's sight with macular degeneration. I've actually interviewed a woman who had the operation, and, you know, even though her sight is still not crystal clear, she can make out shapes, and it's given her an enormous amount of independence. But we're making enormous strides. They're already working. There's this one company in particular in California I talk about that is already working on a second generation that will help actually restore sight to people who were born blind, never mind with macular degeneration. So I see a lot of hope on that. Also in the kidney front, I don't think we need to create these chimeras. There's a lot of great research, and I've reported it on for ABC News and elsewhere, where they are now able to create, using stem cells, to create artificial organs. So
that are more tailored for the person. Yeah.
Yeah. Hang in there, brother. That is really where the technology is very hopeful.
And that's where we'll have to end it with Michael Gillen. The book picks up the rest, though. Thank you so much for your time and for your joyful spirit, and looking forward to carrying on with Open Lines next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.